Up you go, Macmillan. Careful there, Miss Fawcett. Pinch it hard, it'll stop bleeding in a second, Boot. I think I'd better teach you how to block unfriendly spells, said Lockhart, standing flustered in the middle of the hall. He glanced at Snape, whose black eyes glinted, and looked quickly away. Let's have a volunteer pair. Longbottom and Finch Fletchley, how about you?
A bad idea, Professor Lockhart, said Snape, gliding over like a large and malevolent bat.
Longbottom causes devastation with the simplest spells. We'll be sending what's left of Finch Fletchley up to the hospital wing in a matchbox.
Neville's round pink face went pinker.
How about Malfoy and Potter? Said Snape with a twisted smile.
Excellent idea, said Lockhart, gesturing Harry and Malfoy into the middle of the hall as the crowd backed away to give them room.
Now, Harry, said Lockhart, when Draco points his wand at you, you do this.
He raised his own wand, attempted a complicated sort of wiggling action, and dropped it. Snape smirked as Lockhart quickly picked it up, saying, Whoops! My wand is a little overexcited.
Snape moved closer to Malfoy, bent down and whispered something in his ear. Malfoy smirked, too.
Harry looked up nervously at Lockhart and said, Professor, could you show me that blocking thing again?
Scared, muttered Malfoy, so that Lockhart couldn't hear him.
You wish, said Harry out of the corner of his mouth.
Lockhart cuffed Harry merrily on the shoulder.
Just do what I did, Harry.
What, drop my wand?
But Lockhart wasn't listening.
3, 2, 1, go, he shouted.
Malfoy raised his wand quickly and bellowed, Sapensosha!
The end of his wand exploded. Harry watched, aghast, as a long black snake shot out of it, fell heavily onto the floor between them, and raised itself ready to strike. There were screams as the crowd backed swiftly away, clearing the floor.
Don't move, Potter, said Snape lazily, clearly enjoying the sight of Harry standing motionless, eye to eye with the angry snake. I'll get rid of it.
Allow me, shouted Lockhart. He brandished his wand at the snake, and there was a loud bang. The snake, instead of vanishing, flew 10 feet into the air and fell back to the floor with a loud smack. Enraged, hissing furiously, it slithered straight toward Justin Finch Fletchley and raised itself again, fangs exposed, poised to strike.
Harry wasn't sure what made him do it. He wasn't even aware of deciding to do it. All he knew was that his legs were carrying him forward, as though he was on casters, and that he had shouted stupidly at the snake, "Leave him alone!" And miraculously, inexplicably, the snake slumped to the floor, docile as a thick black garden hose, its eyes now on Harry.
Harry felt the fear drain out of him. He knew the snake wouldn't attack anyone now. Though how he knew it, he couldn't have explained.
He looked up at Justin, grinning, expecting to see Justin looking relieved or puzzled or even grateful, but certainly not angry and scared.
"What do you think you're playing at?" he shouted, and before Harry could say anything, Justin had turned and stormed out of the hall.
Snape stepped forward, waved his wand, and the snake vanished in a small puff of black smoke.
Snape, too, was looking at Harry in an unexpected way. It was a shrewd and calculating look, and Harry didn't like it. He was also dimly aware of an ominous muttering all around the walls. Then he felt a tugging on the back of his robes.
"Come on," said Ron's voice in his ear. "Move. Come on."
Ron steered him out of the hall, Hermione hurrying alongside them. As they went through the doors, the people on either side drew away as though they were frightened of catching something. Harry didn't have a clue what was going on. Neither Ron nor Hermione explained anything until they had dragged him all the way up to the empty Gryffindor common room. Then Ron pushed Harry into an armchair and said, "You're a parcel mouth. Why didn't you tell us?"
"I'm a what?" said Harry.
"A parcel mouth," said Ron. "You can talk to snakes."
"I know," said Harry. "I mean, that's only the second time I've ever done it. I accidentally set a boa constrictor on my cousin Dudley at the zoo once. Long story. But it was telling me it had never seen Brazil, and I sort of set it free without meaning to. That was before I knew I was a wizard." "A boa constrictor told you it had never seen Brazil?" Ron repeated faintly. "So?" said Harry. "I bet loads of people here can do it." "Oh, no, they can't," said Ron. "It's not a very common gift. Harry, this is bad."
"What's bad?" said Harry, starting to feel quite angry. "What's wrong with everyone? Listen, if I hadn't told that snake not to attack Justin..."
"Oh, that's what you said to it."
"What do you mean? You were there. You heard me."
"I heard you speaking parcel tongue," said Ron. "Snake language. You could have been saying anything. No wonder Justin panicked. You sounded like you were egging the snake on or something. It was creepy, you know."
Harry gaped at him. "I spoke a different language? But I didn't realize. How can I speak a language without knowing I can speak it?"
Ron shook his head. Both he and Hermione were looking as though someone had died. Harry couldn't see what was so terrible. "Do you want to tell me what's wrong with stopping a massive snake biting off Justin's head?" he said. "What does it matter how I did it, as long as Justin doesn't have to join the headless hunt?"
"It matters," said Hermione, speaking at last in a hushed voice, "because being able to talk to snakes was what Salazar Slytherin was famous for. That's why the symbol of Slytherin House is a serpent."
Harry's mouth fell open. "Exactly," said Ron. "And now the whole school's going to think you're his great-great-great-great-grandson or something."
"But I'm not," said Harry, with a panic he couldn't quite explain. "You'll find that hard to prove," said Hermione. "He lived about 1,000 years ago. For all we know, you could be."
Harry lay awake for hours that night. Through a gap in the curtains around his four-poster, he watched snow starting to drift past the tower window and wondered, could he be a descendant of Salazar Slytherin? He didn't know anything about his father's family, after all. The Dursleys had always forbidden questions about his wizarding relatives. Quietly, Harry tried to say something in parcel tongue. The words wouldn't come out. It seemed he had to be face to face with a snake to do it.
"But I'm in Gryffindor," Harry thought. "The sorting hat wouldn't have put me in here if I had Slytherin blood."
"Ah," said a nasty little voice in his brain, "but the sorting hat wanted to put you in Slytherin, don't you remember?" Harry turned over. He'd see Justin the next day in Herbology, and he'd explain that he'd been calling the snake off, not egging it on, which, he thought angrily, pummeling his pillow, any fool should have realized. By next morning, however, the snow that had begun in the night had turned into a blizzard so thick that the last Herbology lesson of the term was cancelled. Professor Sprout wanted to fit socks and scarves on the mandrakes, a tricky operation she would entrust to no one else, now that it was so important for the mandrakes to grow quickly and revive Mrs. Norris and Colin Creevy. Harry fretted about this next to the fire in the Gryffindor common room, while Ron and Hermione used their time off to play a game of wizard chess.
"For heaven's sake, Harry," said Hermione, exasperated, as one of Ron's bishops wrestled her knight off his horse and dragged him off the board. "Go and find Justin if it's so important to you."
So Harry got up and left through the portrait hole, wondering where Justin might be. The castle was darker than it usually was in daytime because of the thick, swirling grey snow at every window. Shivering, Harry walked past classrooms where lessons were taking place, catching snatches of what was happening within. Professor McGonagall was shouting at someone who, by the sound of it, had turned his friend into a badger. Resisting the urge to take a look, Harry walked on by, thinking that Justin might be using his free time to catch up on some work, and deciding to check the library first. A group of the Hufflepuffs who should have been in Herbology were indeed sitting at the back of the library, but they didn't seem to be working. Between the long lines of high bookshelves, Harry could see that their heads were close together, and they were having what looked like an absorbing conversation. He couldn't see whether Justin was among them. He was walking toward them when something of what they were saying met his ears, and he paused to listen, hidden in the invisibility section.
"So anyway,"
a stout boy was saying. I told Justin to hide up in our dormitory. I mean to say, if Potter's marked him down as his next victim, it's best if he keeps a low profile for a while. Of course, Justin's been waiting for something like this to happen ever since he let slip to Potter he was muggle-born. Justin actually told him he'd been down for Eton. That's not the kind of thing you bandy about with Slytherin's heir on the loose, is it?
You definitely think it is Potter, then, Ernie, said a girl with blonde pigtails anxiously.
Hannah, said the stout boy solemnly, he's a parcel mouth. Everyone knows that's the mark of a dark wizard. Have you ever heard of a decent one who could talk to snakes? They call Slytherin himself Serpent Tongue.
There was some heavy murmuring at this, and Ernie went on.
Remember what was written on the wall? Enemies of the air, beware. Potter had some sort of run-in with Filch. Next thing we know, Filch's cats attacked. That first year, Creevy was annoying Potter at the Quidditch match, taking pictures of him while he was lying in the mud. Next thing we know, Creevy's been attacked.
He's always seemed so nice, though, said Hannah uncertainly. And, well, he's the one who made you-know-who disappear. He can't be all bad, can he?
Ernie lowered his voice mysteriously. The Hufflepuffs bent closer, and Harry edged nearer so that he could catch Ernie's words.
No one knows how he survived that attack by you-know-who. I mean to say, he was only a baby when it happened. He should have been blasted into smithereens. Only a really powerful dark wizard could have survived a curse like that.
He dropped his voice until it was barely more than a whisper and said,
That's probably why you-know-who wanted to kill him in the first place. Didn't want another Dark Lord competing with him. I wonder what other powers Potter's been hiding.
Harry couldn't take any more. Clearing his throat loudly, he stepped out from behind the bookshelves. If he hadn't been feeling so angry, he would have found the sight that greeted him funny. Every one of the Hufflepuffs looked as though they had been petrified by the sight of him, and the colour was draining out of Ernie's face. Hello, said Harry. I'm looking for Justin Finch Fletchley. The Hufflepuffs' worst fears had clearly been confirmed. They all looked fearfully at Ernie.
What do you want with him? Said Ernie in a quavering voice.
I wanted to tell him what really happened with that snake at the dueling club, said Harry. Ernie bit his white lips and then, taking a deep breath, said,
We were all there. We saw what happened.
Then you noticed that after I spoke to it, the snake backed off, said Harry.
All I saw, said Ernie stubbornly, though he was trembling as he spoke, was you speaking parcel tongue and chasing the snake toward Justin. I didn't chase it at him, Harry said, his voice shaking with anger. It didn't even touch him. It was a very near miss, said Ernie. And in case you're getting ideas, he added hastily, I might tell you that you can trace my family back through 9 generations of witches and warlocks, and my blood's as pure as anyone's, so I don't care what sort of blood you've got, said Harry fiercely. Why would I want to attack muggle-borns? I've heard you hate those muggles you live with, said Ernie swiftly.
It's not possible to live with the Dursleys and not hate them, said Harry. I'd like to see you try it. He turned on his heel and stormed out of the library, earning himself a reproving glare from Madam Pince, who was polishing the gilded cover of a large spellbook. Harry blundered up the corridor, barely noticing where he was going. He was in such a fury. The result was that he walked into something very large and solid, which knocked him backward onto the floor. "Oh, hello, Hagrid," Harry said, looking up. Hagrid's face was entirely hidden by a woolly, snow-covered balaclava, but it couldn't possibly be anyone else, as he filled most of the corridor in his moleskin overcoat. A dead rooster was hanging from one of his massive gloved hands.
All right, Harry, he said, pulling up the balaclava so he could speak. Why aren't you in class?
Cancelled, said Harry, getting up.
What are you doing in here?
Hagrid held up the limp rooster.
Second one killed this term, he explained. It's either foxes or a blood-sucking bugbear, and I need the headmaster's permission to put a charm around the end coop.
He peered more closely at Harry from under his thick, snow-flecked eyebrows.
You sure you're all right? You look all hot and bothered.
Harry couldn't bring himself to repeat what Ernie and the rest of the Hufflepuffs had been saying about him.
It's nothing, he said.
I better get going, Hagrid. It's Transfiguration next, and I've got to pick up my books. He walked off, his mind still full of what Ernie had said about him.
Justin's been waiting for something like this to happen ever since he let slip to Potter he was Muggle-born.
Harry stamped up the stairs and turned along another corridor which was particularly dark. The torches had been extinguished by a strong, icy draught that was blowing through a loose window pane. He was halfway down a passage when he tripped headlong over something lying on the floor. He turned to squint at what he'd fallen over and felt as though his stomach had dissolved. Justin Finch Fletchley was lying on the floor, rigid and cold, a look of shock frozen on his face, his eyes staring blankly at the ceiling, and that wasn't all. Next to him was another figure, the strangest sight Harry had ever seen. It was nearly headless Nick, no longer pearly white and transparent, but black and smoky, floating, immobile and horizontal, 6 inches off the floor. His head was half off, and his face wore an expression of shock, identical to Justin's. Harry got to his feet, his breathing fast and shallow, his heart doing a kind of drum roll against his ribs. He looked wildly up and down the deserted corridor and saw a line of spiders scuttling as fast as they could away from the bodies. The only sounds were the muffled voices of teachers from the classes on either side. He could run, and no one would ever know he had been there. But he couldn't just leave them lying here. He had to get help. Would anyone believe he hadn't had anything to do with this? As he stood there, panicking, a door right next to him opened with a bang. Peeves, the poltergeist, came shooting out.
"Why, it's Potty Wee Potter!"
cackled Peeves, knocking Harry's glasses askew as he bounced past him.
"What's Potter up to? Why is Potter lurking?"
Peeves stopped, halfway through a mid-air somersault. Upside down, he spotted Justin and nearly headless Nick. He flipped the right way up, filled his lungs, and before Harry could stop him, screamed,
"Attack! Attack! Another attack! No mortal or ghost is safe! Run for your lives! Attack!"
Crash, crash, crash. Door after door flew open along the corridor and people flooded out. For several long minutes there was a scene of such confusion that Justin was in danger of being squashed, and people kept standing in nearly headless Nick. Harry found himself pinned against the wall as the teachers shouted for quiet. Professor McGonagall came running, followed by her own class, one of whom still had black and white striped hair. She used her wand to set off a loud bang, which restored silence, and ordered everyone back into their classes. No sooner had the scene cleared somewhat than Ernie, the Hufflepuff, arrived panting on the scene.
"Caught in the act!"
Ernie yelled, his face stark white, pointing his finger dramatically at Harry.
"That will do, Macmillan," said Professor McGonagall sharply. Peeves was bobbing overhead, now grinning wickedly, surveying the scene. Peeves always loved chaos. As the teachers bent over Justin and nearly headless Nick, examining them, Peeves broke into song.
"Oh, Potter, you rotter, oh, what have you done? You're killing off students, you think it's good fun."
"That's enough, Peeves," barked Professor McGonagall, and Peeves zoomed away backward with his tongue out at Harry. Justin was carried up to the hospital wing by Professor Flitwick and Professor Sinistra of the astronomy department. But nobody seemed to know what to do for nearly headless Nick. In the end, Professor McGonagall conjured a large fan out of thin air, which he gave to Ernie with instructions to waft nearly headless Nick up the stairs. This Ernie did, fanning Nick along like a silent black hovercraft. This left Harry and Professor McGonagall alone together.
"This way, Potter," she said.
"Professor," said Harry at once, "I swear I didn't."
"This is out of my hands, Potter," said Professor McGonagall curtly.
They marched in silence around a corner, and she stopped before a large and extremely ugly stone gargoyle.
"Lemon drop," she said.
This was evidently a password, because the gargoyle sprang suddenly to life and hopped aside as the wall behind him split in two. Even full of dread for what was coming, Harry couldn't fail to be amazed. Behind the wall was a spiral staircase that was moving smoothly upward like an escalator. As he and Professor McGonagall stepped onto it, Harry heard the wall thud closed behind them. They rose upward in circles, higher and higher, until at last, slightly dizzy, Harry saw a gleaming oak door ahead with a brass knocker in the shape of a griffin. He knew now where he was being taken. This must be where Dumbledore lived. Chapter 12. The Polyjuice Potion. They stepped off the stone staircase at the top, and Professor McGonagall rapped on the door. It opened silently, and they entered. Professor McGonagall told Harry to wait and left him there, alone. Harry looked around. One thing was certain. Of all the teachers' offices Harry had visited so far this year, Dumbledore's was by far the most interesting. If he hadn't been scared out of his wits that he was about to be thrown out of school, he would have been very pleased to have a chance to look around it. It was a large and beautiful circular room, full of funny little noises. A number of curious silver instruments stood on spindle-legged tables, whirring and emitting little puffs of smoke. The walls were covered with portraits of old headmasters and headmistresses, all of whom were snoozing gently in their frames. There was also an enormous claw-footed desk, and, sitting on a shelf behind it, a shabby, tattered wizard's hat, the Sorting Hat. Harry hesitated. He cast a wary eye around the sleeping witches and wizards on the walls. Surely it couldn't hurt if he took the hat down and tried it on again, just to see, just to make sure it had put him in the right house. He walked quietly round the desk, lifted the hat from its shelf, and lowered it slowly onto his head. It was much too large, and it slipped down over his eyes, just as it had done the last time he put it on. Harry stared at the black inside of the hat, waiting. Then a small voice said in his ear,
"Be in your bonnet, Harry Potter?"
Yes, Harry muttered. Sorry to bother you. I wanted to ask..."
"You've been wondering whether I put you in the right house,"
said the hat smartly.
"Yes, you were particularly difficult to place, but I stand by what I said before."
Harry's heart leapt.
"You would have done well in Slytherin."
Harry's stomach plummeted. He grabbed the point of the hat and pulled it off. It hung limply in his hand, grubby and faded. Harry pushed it back onto its shelf, feeling sick. "You're wrong," he said aloud to the still and silent hat. It didn't move. Harry backed away, watching it, and then a strange gagging noise behind him made him wheel around. He wasn't alone, after all. Standing on a golden perch behind the door was a decrepit-looking bird that resembled a half-plucked turkey. Harry stared at it, and the bird looked balefully back, making its gagging noise again. Harry thought it looked very ill. Its eyes were dull, and even as Harry watched, a couple more feathers fell out of its tail. Harry was just thinking that all he needed was for Dumbledore's pet bird to die while he was alone in the office with it, when the bird burst into flames. Harry yelled in shock and backed away into the desk. He looked feverishly around in case there was a glass of water somewhere, but couldn't see one. The bird, meanwhile, had become a fireball. It gave one loud shriek, and next second there was nothing but a smouldering pile of ash on the floor. The office door opened. Dumbledore came in, looking very somber.
"Professor," Harry gasped, "your bird. I couldn't do anything. He just caught fire."
To Harry's astonishment, Dumbledore smiled.
"About time, too," he said. "He's been looking dreadful for days. I've been telling him to get a move on."
He chuckled at the stunned look on Harry's face.
"Fawkes is a phoenix, Harry. Phoenixes burst into flame when it's time for them to die and are reborn from the ashes. Watch him."
Harry looked down in time to see a tiny, wrinkled, newborn bird poke its head out of the ashes. It was quite as ugly as the old one.
"It's a shame you had to see him on a burning day," said Dumbledore, seating himself behind his desk. "He's really very handsome most of the time. Wonderful red and gold plumage. Fascinating creatures, phoenixes. They can carry immensely heavy loads. Their tears have healing powers, and they make highly faithful pets."
In the shock of Fawkes catching fire, Harry had forgotten what he was there for, but it all came back to him as Dumbledore settled himself in the high chair behind the desk and fixed Harry with his penetrating light blue stare. Before Dumbledore could speak another word, however, the door of the office flew open with an almighty bang, and Hagrid burst in, a wild look in his eyes, his balaclava perched on top of his shaggy black head, and the dead rooster still swinging from his hand.
"It wasn't Harry, Professor Dumbledore," said Hagrid urgently. "I was talking to him seconds before that kid was found. He never had time, sir."
Dumbledore tried to say something, but Hagrid went ranting on, waving the rooster around in his agitation, sending feathers everywhere.
"It can't have been him. I'll swear it in front of the Ministry of Magic if I have to. Hagrid, I..." "You've got the wrong boy, sir. I know Harry never..."
"Hagrid," said Dumbledore loudly, "I do not think that Harry attacked those people."
"Oh,"
said Hagrid, the rooster falling limply at his side.
"Right. I'll wait outside then, Headmaster."
And he stomped out, looking embarrassed.
"You don't think it was me, Professor?"
Harry repeated hopefully, as Dumbledore brushed rooster feathers off his desk.
"No, Harry, I don't,"
said Dumbledore, though his face was somber again.
"But I still want to talk to you."
Harry waited nervously while Dumbledore considered him, the tips of his long fingers together.
"I must ask you, Harry, whether there is anything you'd like to tell me," he said gently. "Anything at all?"
Harry didn't know what to say. He thought of Malfoy shouting, "You'll be next, mudbloods," and of the Polyjuice potion simmering away in Moaning Myrtle's bathroom. Then he thought of the disembodied voice he had heard twice, and remembered what Ron had said. Hearing voices no one else can hear isn't a good sign, even in the wizarding world. He thought, too, about what everyone was saying about him, and his growing dread that he was somehow connected with Salazar Slytherin.
"No," said Harry, "there isn't anything, Professor."
The double attack on Justin and nearly headless Nick turned what had hitherto been nervousness into real panic. Curiously, it was nearly headless Nick's fate that seemed to worry people most. What could possibly do that to a ghost, people asked each other. What terrible power could harm someone who was already dead? There was almost a stampede to book seats on the Hogwarts Express so that students could go home for Christmas.
"At this rate, we'll be the only ones left," Ron told Harry and Hermione. "Us, Malfoy, Crabbe, and Goyle. What a jolly holiday it's going to be."
Crabbe and Goyle, who always did whatever Malfoy did, had signed up to stay over the holidays too, but Harry was glad that most people were leaving. He was tired of people skirting around him in the corridors as though he was about to sprout fangs or spit poison, tired of all the muttering, pointing, and hissing as he passed. Fred and George, however, found all this very funny. They went out of their way to march ahead of Harry down the corridors, shouting, "Make way for the heir of Slytherin, seriously evil wizard coming through." Percy was deeply disapproving of this behavior.
"It is not a laughing matter," he said coldly.
"Oh, get out of the way, Percy," said Fred. "Harry's in a hurry."
"Yeah, he's off to the Chamber of Secrets for a cup of tea with his fang servant," said George, chortling.
Ginny didn't find it amusing either.
"Oh, don't,"
she wailed every time Fred asked Harry loudly who he was planning to attack next, or George pretended to ward Harry off with a large clove of garlic when they met. Harry didn't mind. It made him feel better that Fred and George at least thought the idea of his being Slytherin's heir was quite ludicrous. But their antics seemed to be aggravating Draco Malfoy, who looked increasingly sour each time he saw them at it.
"It's because he's bursting to say it's really him," said Ron knowingly. "You know how he hates anyone beating him at anything, and you're getting all the credit for his dirty work."
"Not for long," said Hermione in a satisfied tone. "The Polyjuice potion's nearly ready. We'll be getting the truth out of him any day now."
At last the term ended, and a silence deep as the snow on the grounds descended on the castle. Harry found it peaceful rather than gloomy, and enjoyed the fact that he, Hermione, and the Weasleys had the run of Gryffindor Tower, which meant they could play Exploding Snap loudly without bothering anyone, and practice dueling in private. Fred, George, and Ginny had chosen to stay at school rather than visit Bill in Egypt with Mr. and Mrs. Weasley. Percy, who disapproved of what he termed their childish behaviour, didn't spend much time in the Gryffindor common room. He had already told them pompously that he was only staying over Christmas because it was his duty as a prefect to support the teachers during this troubled time. Christmas morning dawned, cold and white. Harry and Ron, the only ones left in their dormitory, were woken very early by Hermione, who burst in, fully dressed and carrying presents for them both.
"Wake up,"
she said loudly, pulling back the curtains at the window.
"Hermione, you're not supposed to be in here,"
said Ron, shielding his eyes against the light.
"Merry Christmas to you, too,"
said Hermione, throwing him his presents.
"I've been up for nearly an hour, adding more lace wings to the potion. It's ready."
Harry sat up, suddenly wide awake.
"Are you sure?"
"Positive,"
said Hermione, shifting Scabbers the rat so that she could sit down on the end of Ron's four-poster.
"If we're going to do it, I say it should be tonight."
At that moment, Hedwig swooped into the room, carrying a very small package in her beak.
"Hello," said Harry happily as she landed on his bed. "Are you speaking to me again?"
She nibbled his ear in an affectionate sort of way, which was a far better present than the one she had bought him, which turned out to be from the Dursleys. They had sent Harry a toothpick and a note telling him to find out whether he'd be able to stay at Hogwarts for the summer vacation too. The rest of Harry's Christmas presents were far more satisfactory. Hagrid had sent him a large tin of treacle fudge, which Harry decided to soften by the fire before eating. Ron had given him a book called Flying with the Cannons, a book of interesting facts about his favourite Quidditch team, and Hermione had brought him a luxury eagle feather quill. Harry opened the last present to find a new hand-knitted sweater from Mrs. Weasley and a large plum cake. He read her card with a fresh surge of guilt, thinking about Mr. Weasley's car, which hadn't been seen since its crash with the Whomping Willow, and the bout of rule-breaking he and Ron were planning next. No one, not even someone dreading taking Polyjuice Potion later, could fail to enjoy Christmas dinner at Hogwarts. The Great Hall looked magnificent. Not only were there a dozen frost-covered Christmas trees and thick streamers of holly and mistletoe crisscrossing the ceiling, but enchanted snow was falling, warm and dry from the ceiling. Dumbledore led them in a few of his favourite carols, Hagrid booming more and more loudly with every goblet of eggnog he consumed. Percy, who hadn't noticed that Fred had bewitched his prefect badge so that it now read Pinhead, kept asking them all what they were sniggering at. Harry didn't even care that Draco Malfoy was making loud, snide remarks about his new sweater from the Slytherin table. With a bit of luck, Malfoy would be getting his comeuppance in a few hours' time. Harry and Ron had barely finished their third helpings of Christmas pudding when Hermione ushered them out of the hall to finalize their plans for the evening.
"We still need a bit of the people you're changing into,"
said Hermione matter-of-factly, as though she was sending them to the supermarket for laundry detergent.
"And obviously, it'll be best if you can get something of Crabbe's and Goyle's. They're Malfoy's best friends. He'll tell them anything. And we also need to make sure the real Crabbe and Goyle can't burst in on us while we're interrogating him." "I've got it all worked out,"
she went on smoothly, ignoring Harry's and Ron's stupefied faces. She held up two plump chocolate cakes.
"I've filled these with a simple sleeping draught. All you have to do is to make sure Crabbe and Goyle find them. You know how greedy they are. They're bound to eat them. Once they're asleep, pull out a few of their hairs and hide them in a broom closet."
Harry and Ron looked incredulously at each other.
"Hermione, I don't think..."
"That could go seriously wrong." But Hermione had a steely glint in her eye, not unlike the one Professor McGonagall sometimes had.
"The potion will be useless without Crabbe's and Goyle's hair,"
she said sternly.
"You do want to investigate Malfoy, don't you?" "Oh, all right, all right," said Harry. "But what about you? Whose hair are you ripping out?" "I've already got mine,"
said Hermione brightly, pulling a tiny bottle out of her pocket and showing them the single hair inside it.
"Remember Millicent Bulstrode wrestling with me at the dueling club? She left this on my robes when she was trying to strangle me. And she's gone home for Christmas, so I'll just have to tell the Slytherins I've decided to come back."
When Hermione had bustled off to check on the Polyjuice potion again, Ron turned to Harry with a doom-laden expression.
"Have you ever heard of a plan where so many things could go wrong?"
But to Harry's and Ron's utter amazement, stage one of the operation went just as smoothly as Hermione had said.
They lurked in the deserted entrance hall after Christmas tea, waiting for Crabbe and Goyle, who had remained alone at the Slytherin table, shoveling down fourth helpings of trifle. Harry had perched the chocolate cakes on the end of the banisters. When they spotted Crabbe and Goyle coming out of the great hall, Harry and Ron hid quickly behind a suit of armour next to the front door.
"How thick can you get?"
Ron whispered ecstatically as Crabbe gleefully pointed out the cakes to Goyle and grabbed them. Grinning stupidly, they stuffed the cakes whole into their large mouths. For a moment, both of them chewed greedily, looks of triumph on their faces. Then, without the smallest change of expression, they both keeled over backward onto the floor. By far the hardest part was hiding them in the closet across the hall. Once they were safely stowed among the buckets and mops, Harry yanked out a couple of the bristles that covered Goyle's forehead, and Ron pulled out several of Crabbe's hairs. They also stole their shoes, because their own were far too small for Crabbe and Goyle-sized feet. Then, still stunned at what they had just done, they sprinted up to Moaning Myrtle's bathroom. They could hardly see for the thick black smoke issuing from the stall in which Hermione was stirring the cauldron. Pulling their robes up over their faces, Harry and Ron knocked softly on the door.
"Hermione!"
They heard the scrape of the lock, and Hermione emerged, shiny-faced and looking anxious. Behind her they heard the gloop-gloop of the bubbling, glutinous potion. Three glass tumblers stood ready on the toilet seat.
"Did you get them?"
Hermione asked breathlessly. Harry showed her Goyle's hair.
"Good, and I sneaked these spare robes out of the laundry," Hermione said, holding up a small sack. "You'll need bigger sizes once you're Crabbe and Goyle."
The three of them stared into the cauldron. Close up, the potion looked like thick, dark mud, bubbling sluggishly.
"I'm sure I've done everything right,"
said Hermione, nervously rereading the splotched page of Most Potent Potions.
"It looks like the book says it should. Once we've drunk it, we'll have exactly an hour before we change back into ourselves."
"Now what?"
Ron whispered.
"We separate it into three glasses and add the hairs."
Hermione ladled large dollops of the potion into each of the glasses, and then her hand trembling, she shook Millicent Bulstrode's hair out of its bottle into the first glass. The potion hissed loudly like a boiling kettle and frothed madly. A second later, it had turned a sick sort of yellow.
"Blech! Essence of Millicent Bulstrode," said Ron, eyeing it with loathing. "Bet it tastes disgusting."
"Had yours, then," said Hermione.
Harry dropped Goyle's hair into the middle glass, and Ron put Crabbe's into the last one. Both glasses hissed and frothed. Goyle's turned the khaki color of a booger. Crabbe's a dark, murky brown.
"Hang on," said Harry as Ron and Hermione reached for their glasses. "We'd better not all drink them in here. Once we turn into Crabbe and Goyle, we won't fit, and Millicent Bulstrode's no pixie."
"Good thinking," said Ron, unlocking the door. "We'll take separate stalls." Careful not to spill a drop of his polyjuice potion, Harry slipped into the middle stall.
"Ready?"
he called.
"Ready,"
came Ron's and Hermione's voices. "One, two, three." Pinching his nose, Harry drank the potion down in two large gulps. It tasted like overcooked cabbage. Immediately, his inside started writhing as though he'd just swallowed live snakes. Doubled up, he wondered whether he was going to be sick. Then a burning sensation spread rapidly from his stomach to the very ends of his fingers and toes. Next, bringing him gasping to all fours, came a horrible melting feeling as the skin all over his body bubbled like hot wax. And before his eyes, his hands began to grow. The fingers thickened, the nails broadened, the knuckles were bulging like bolts. His shoulders stretched painfully, and a prickling on his forehead told him that hair was creeping down toward his eyebrows. His robes ripped as his chest expanded like a barrel bursting its hoops. His feet were agony in shoes four sizes too small. As suddenly as it had started, everything stopped. Harry lay face down on the stone-cold floor, listening to Myrtle gurgling morosely in the end toilet. With difficulty, he kicked off his shoes and stood up. So this is what it felt like being Goyle. His large hand trembling, he pulled off his old robes, which were hanging a foot above his ankles, pulled on the spare ones, and laced up Goyle's boat-like shoes. He reached up to brush his hair out of his eyes, and met only the short growth of wiry bristles low on his forehead.
Then he realized that his glasses were clouding his eyes, because Goyle obviously didn't need them. He took them off and called,
"Are you two okay?"
Goyle's low rasp of a voice issued from his mouth.
"Yeah,"
came the deep grunt of Crab from his right. Harry unlocked his door and stepped in front of the cracked mirror. Goyle stared back at him out of dull, deep-set eyes. Harry scratched his ear. So did Goyle. Ron's door opened. They stared at each other. Except that he looked pale and shocked, Ron was indistinguishable from Crab, from the pudding bowl haircut to the long gorilla arms.
"This is unbelievable," said Ron, approaching the mirror and prodding Crab's flat nose. "Unbelievable." "We'd better get going," said Harry, loosening the watch that was cutting into Goyle's thick wrist. "We've still got to find out where the Slytherin common room is. I only hope we can find someone to follow."
Ron, who had been gazing at Harry, said,
"You don't know how bizarre it is to see Goyle thinking."
He banged on Hermione's door.
"Come on, we need to go."
A high-pitched voice answered him.
"I don't think I'm going to come, after all. You go on without me."
"Hermione, we know Millicent Bulstrode's ugly. No one's going to know it's you."
"No, really, I don't think I'll come. You two hurry up, you're wasting time."
Harry looked at Ron, bewildered.
"That looks more like Goyle," said Ron. "That's how he looks every time a teacher asks him a question." "Hermione, are you okay?"
said Harry through the door.
"Fine, I'm fine. Go on."
Harry looked at his watch. 5 of their precious 60 minutes had already passed.
"We'll meet you back here, all right?"
he said. Harry and Ron opened the door of the bathroom carefully, checked that the coast was clear, and set off.
"Don't swing your arms like that," Harry muttered to Ron. "Hey, Crab holds them sort of stiff."
"How's this?"
"Yeah, that's better."
They went down the marble staircase. All they needed now was a Slytherin that they could follow to the Slytherin common room, but there was nobody around.
"Any ideas?"
muttered Harry.
"The Slytherins always come up to breakfast from over there,"
said Ron, nodding at the entrance to the dungeons. The words had barely left his mouth when a girl with long curly hair emerged from the entrance.
"Excuse me,"
said Ron, hurrying up to her.
"We've forgotten our way to our common room."
"I beg your pardon," said the girl stiffly. "Our common room? I'm a Ravenclaw."
She walked away, looking suspiciously back at them. Harry and Ron hurried down the stone steps into the darkness, their footsteps echoing particularly loudly as Crabbe's and Goyle's huge feet hit the floor, feeling that this wasn't going to be as easy as they had hoped. The labyrinthine passages were deserted. They walked deeper and deeper under the school, constantly checking their watches to see how much time they had left. After a quarter of an hour, just when they were getting desperate, they heard a sudden movement ahead.
"Ah," said Ron excitedly. "There's one of them now."
The figure was emerging from a side room. As they hurried nearer, however, their hearts sank. It wasn't a Slytherin. It was Percy.
"What are you doing down here?"
said Ron in surprise. Percy looked affronted. "That," he said stiffly, "is none of your business. It's Crab, isn't it?"
"What? Oh, yeah,"
said Ron. "Well, get off to your dormitories," said Percy sternly. "It's not safe to go wandering around dark corridors these days."
"You are,"
Ron pointed out. "I," said Percy, drawing himself up, "am a prefect. Nothing's about to attack me." A voice suddenly echoed behind Harry and Ron. Draco Malfoy was strolling toward them, and for the first time in his life, Harry was pleased to see him.
"There you are," he drawled, looking at them. "Have you two been pigging out in the Great Hall all this time? I've been looking for you. I want to show you something really funny."
Malfoy glanced witheringly at Percy.
"And what are you doing down here, Weasley?" he sneered.
Percy looked outraged. "You want to show a bit more respect to a school prefect," he said.
"I don't like your attitude."
Malfoy sneered and motioned for Harry and Ron to follow him. Harry almost said something apologetic to Percy, but caught himself just in time. He and Ron hurried after Malfoy, who said, as they turned into the next passage,
"That Peter Weasley."
"Percy,"
Ron corrected him automatically.
"Whatever," said Malfoy. I've noticed him sneaking around a lot lately, and I bet I know what he's up to. He thinks he's going to catch Slytherin's heir single-handed.
He gave a short, derisive laugh. Harry and Ron exchanged excited looks. Malfoy paused by a stretch of bare, damp stone wall.
What's the new password again?
He said to Harry.
Said Harry. Oh, yeah, pure blood, said Malfoy, not listening,
and a stone door concealed in the wall slid open. Malfoy marched through it, and Harry and Ron followed him. The Slytherin common room was a large, low, underground room with rough stone walls and ceiling, from which round, greenish lamps were hanging on chains. A fire was crackling under an elaborately carved mantelpiece ahead of them, and several Slytherins were silhouetted around it in high-backed chairs.
"Wait here," said Malfoy to Harry and Ron, motioning them to a pair of empty chairs set back from the fire. "I'll go and get it. My father just sent it to me."
Wondering what Malfoy was going to show them, Harry and Ron sat down, doing their best to look at home. Malfoy came back a minute later, holding what looked like a newspaper clipping. He thrust it under Ron's nose.
"That'll give you a laugh," he said.
Harry saw Ron's eyes widen in shock. He read the clipping quickly, gave a very forced laugh, and handed it to Harry. It had been clipped out of the Daily Prophet, and it said, "Inquiry at the Ministry of Magic. Arthur Weasley, head of the Misuse of Muggle Artifacts Office, was today fined 50 galleons for bewitching a Muggle car. Mr. Lucius Malfoy, a governor of Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry, where the enchanted car crashed earlier this year, called today for Mr. Weasley's resignation. Weasley has brought the ministry into disrepute, Mr. Malfoy told our reporter. He is clearly unfit to draw up our laws, and his ridiculous Muggle Protection Act should be scrapped immediately. Mr. Weasley was unavailable for comment, although his wife told reporters to clear off or she'd set the family ghoul on them.
Well, said Malfoy impatiently, as Harry handed the clipping back to him, don't you think it's funny?
Ho ho, said Harry bleakly.
Arthur Weasley loves Muggles so much he should snap his wand in half and go and join them, said Malfoy scornfully. You'd never know the Weasleys were pure bloods the way they behave.
Ron's, or rather Crab's, face was contorted with fury.
What's up with you, Crab? Snapped Malfoy.
Stomachache, Ron grunted.
Well, go up to the hospital wing and give all those mudbloods a kick for me, said Malfoy, sniggering. You know, I'm surprised the Daily Prophet hasn't reported all these attacks yet, he went on thoughtfully. I suppose Dumbledore's trying to hush it all up. He'll be sacked if it doesn't stop soon. Father's always said Dumbledore's the worst thing that's ever happened to this place. He loves Muggle-borns. A decent headmaster would never let slime like that Creevy in.
Malfoy started taking pictures with an imaginary camera and did a cruel but accurate impression of Colin.
Potter, can I have your picture, Potter? Can I have your autograph? Can I lick your shoes, please, Potter?
He dropped his hands and looked at Harry and Ron.
What's the matter with you two?
Far too late, Harry and Ron forced themselves to laugh, but Malfoy seemed satisfied. Perhaps Crabbe and Goyle were always slow on the uptake.
St. Potter, the Mudblood's friend, said Malfoy slowly. He's another one with no proper wizard feeling, or he wouldn't go around with that jumped-up Granger mudblood, and people think he's Slytherin's heir.
Harry and Ron waited with bated breath. Malfoy was surely seconds away from telling them it was him, but then...
I wish I knew who it is, said Malfoy petulantly. I could help them.
Ron's jaw dropped so that Crabbe looked even more clueless than usual. Fortunately, Malfoy didn't notice, and Harry, thinking fast, said,
You must have some idea who's behind it all.
You know I haven't, Goyle. How many times do I have to tell you? Snapped Malfoy. And Father won't tell me anything about the last time the chamber was opened, either. Of course, it was 50 years ago, so it was before his time. But he knows all about it, and he says that it was all kept quiet, and it'll look suspicious if I know too much about it. But I know one thing. Last time the Chamber of Secrets was opened, a mudblood died. So I bet it's a matter of time before one of them's killed this time. I hope it's Granger, he said with relish.
Ron was clenching Crab's gigantic fists. Feeling that it would be a bit of a giveaway if Ron punched Malfoy, Harry shot him a warning look and said,
"Do you know if the person who opened the chamber last time was caught?"
"Oh, yeah, whoever it was expelled," said Malfoy. "They're probably still in Azkaban."
"Azkaban?"
said Harry, puzzled. "Azkaban, the wizard prison goyle," said Malfoy, looking at him in disbelief. "Honestly, if you were any slower, you'd be going backward."
He shifted restlessly in his chair and said,
"Father says to keep my head down and let the heir of Slytherin get on with it. He says the school needs ridding of all the mud-blood filth, but not to get mixed up in it. Of course, he's got a lot on his plate at the moment. You know the Ministry of Magic raided our manor last week?"
Harry tried to force Goyle's dull face into a look of concern.
"Yeah," said Malfoy. "Luckily, they didn't find much. Father's got some very valuable dark arts stuff, but luckily we've got our own secret chamber under the drawing room floor."
"Oh,"
said Ron. Malfoy looked at him. So did Harry. Ron blushed. Even his hair was turning red. His nose was also slowly lengthening. Their hour was up. Ron was turning back into himself, and from the look of horror he was suddenly giving Harry, he must be too. They both jumped to their feet.
"Medicine for my stomach,"
Ron grunted, and without further ado they sprinted the length of the Slytherin common room, hurled themselves at the stone wall, and dashed up the passage, hoping against hope that Malfoy hadn't noticed anything. Harry could feel his feet slipping around in Goyle's huge shoes, and had to hoist up his robes as he shrank. They crashed up the steps into the dark entrance hall, which was full of a muffled pounding coming from the closet where they'd locked Crab and Goyle. Leaving their shoes outside the closet door, they sprinted in their socks up the marble staircase toward Moaning Myrtle's bathroom.
"Well, it wasn't a complete waste of time,"
Ron panted, closing the bathroom door behind them.
"I know we still haven't found out who's doing the attacks, but I'm going to write to Dad tomorrow and tell him to check under the Malfoy's drawing room."
Harry checked his face in the cracked mirror. He was back to normal. He put his glasses on as Ron hammered on the door of Hermione's stall.
"Hermione, come on. We've got loads to tell you."
"Go away,"
Hermione squeaked. Harry and Ron looked at each other.
"What's the matter?" said Ron. "You must be back to normal by now."
But Moaning Myrtle glided suddenly through the stall door. Harry had never seen her looking so happy.
"Oh, wait till you see," she said. "It's awful."
They heard the lock slide back, and Hermione emerged, sobbing, her robes pulled up over her head.
"What's up?" said Ron uncertainly. "Have you still got Millicent's nose or something?"
Hermione let her robes fall, and Ron backed into the sink. Her face was covered in black fur, her eyes had turned yellow, and there were long, pointed ears poking through her hair.
"It was a cat hair,"
she howled.
"Millicent Bulstrode must have a cat, and the potion isn't supposed to be used for animal transformations."
"Uh-oh," said Ron. "You'll be teased something dreadful," said Myrtle happily.
"It's okay, Hermione," said Harry quickly. "We'll take you up to the hospital wing. Madame Pomfrey never asked too many questions."
It took a long time to persuade Hermione to leave the bathroom. Moaning Myrtle sped them on their way with a hearty guffaw.
"Wait till everyone finds out you've got a tail."
Chapter 13, The Very Secret Diary. Hermione remained in the hospital wing for several weeks. There was a flurry of rumor about her disappearance when the rest of the school arrived back from their Christmas holidays, because, of course, everyone thought that she had been attacked. So many students filed past the hospital wing trying to catch a glimpse of her that Madame Pomfrey took out her curtains again and placed them around Hermione's bed to spare her the shame of being seen with a furry face. Harry and Ron went to visit her every evening. When the new term started, they brought her each day's homework. "If I'd sprouted whiskers, I'd take a break from work," said Ron, tipping a stack of books onto Hermione's bedside table one evening.
"Don't be silly, Ron. I've got to keep up," said Hermione briskly.
Her spirits were greatly improved by the fact that all the hair had gone from her face, and her eyes were turning slowly back to brown.
"I don't suppose you've got any new leads," she added in a whisper so that Madame Pomfrey couldn't hear her. "Nothing,"
said Harry gloomily. I was so sure it was Malfoy, said Ron for about the 100th time. What's that? Asked Harry, pointing to something gold sticking out from under Hermione's pillow. Just a get-well card, said Hermione hastily, trying to poke it out of sight, but Ron was too quick for her. He pulled it out, flicked it open, and read aloud, To Miss Granger, wishing you a speedy recovery from your concerned teacher, Professor Gilderoy Lockhart, Order of Merlin, third class, honorary member of the Dark Force Defense League, and five-time winner of Witch Weekly's Most Charming Smile Award. Ron looked up at Hermione, disgusted. You sleep with this under your pillow? But Hermione was spared answering by Madame Pomfrey sweeping over with her evening dose of medicine. Is Lockhart the smarmiest bloke you've ever met, or what? Ron said to Harry as they left the infirmary and started up the stairs toward Gryffindor Tower. Snape had given them so much homework, Harry thought he was likely to be in the sixth year before he finished it. Ron was just saying he wished he had asked Hermione how many rat tails you were supposed to add to a hair-raising potion when an angry outburst from the floor above reached their ears. That's Filch, Harry muttered as they hurried up the stairs and paused out of sight, listening hard. You don't think someone else has been attacked, said Ron tensely. They stood still, their heads inclined toward Filch's voice, which sounded quite hysterical.
Even more work for me, mopping all night like I haven't got enough to do. No, this is the final straw. I'm going to Dumbledore.
His footsteps receded along the out-of-sight corridor, and they heard a distant door slam. They poked their heads around the corner. Filch had clearly been manning his usual lookout post. They were once again on the spot where Mrs. Norris had been attacked. They saw at a glance what Filch had been shouting about. A great flood of water stretched over half the corridor, and it looked as though it was still seeping from under the door of Moaning Myrtle's bathroom. Now that Filch had stopped shouting, they could hear Myrtle's wails echoing off the bathroom walls. "Now what's up with her?" said Ron. "Let's go and see," said Harry. And, holding their robes over their ankles, they stepped through the great wash of water to the door bearing its Out of Order sign, ignored it, as always, and entered. Moaning Myrtle was crying, if possible, louder and harder than ever before. She seemed to be hiding down her usual toilet. It was dark in the bathroom because the candles had been extinguished in the great rush of water that had left both walls and floor soaking wet. "What's up, Myrtle?" said Harry.
"Who's that?" glugged Myrtle miserably. "Come to throw something else at me."
Harry waded across to her stall and said, "Why would I throw something at you?"
"Don't ask me,"
Myrtle shouted, emerging with a wave of yet more water which splashed onto the already sopping floor.
"Here I am, minding my own business, and someone thinks it's funny to throw a book at me."
"But it can't hurt you if someone throws something at you," said Harry reasonably. "I mean, it'd just go right through you, wouldn't it?" He has said the wrong thing. Myrtle puffed herself up and shrieked,
"Let's all throw books at Myrtle, because she can't feel it. 10 points if you can get it through her stomach. 50 points if it goes through her head. Well, what a lovely game, I don't think."
"Who threw it at you anyway?" asked Harry.
"I don't know. I was just sitting in the yew bend, thinking about death, and it fell right through the top of my head,"
said Myrtle, glaring at them.
"It's over there. It got washed out."
Harry and Ron looked under the sink where Myrtle was pointing. A small, thin book lay there. It had a shabby black cover and was as wet as everything else in the bathroom. Harry stepped forward to pick it up, but Ron suddenly flung out an arm to hold him back. "What?" said Harry.
"Are you crazy?" said Ron. "It could be dangerous."
"Dangerous?" said Harry, laughing. "Come off it. How could it be dangerous?" "You'd be surprised," said Ron, who was looking apprehensively at the book. "Some of the books the Ministry's confiscated, Dad's told me, there was one that burned your eyes out, and everyone who read Sonnets of a Sorcerer spoke in limericks for the rest of their lives, and some old witch in Bath had a book that you could never stop reading. You just had to wander around with your nose in it, trying to do everything one-handed, and..."
"All right, I've got the point," said Harry.
The little book lay on the floor, nondescript and soggy.
"Well, we won't find out unless we look at it,"
he said, and he ducked around Ron and picked it up off the floor. Harry saw at once that it was a diary, and the faded year on the cover told him it was 50 years old. He opened it eagerly. On the first page he could just make out the name T.M. Riddle in smudged ink.
"Hang on," said Ron, who had approached cautiously and was looking over Harry's shoulder. "I know that name. T.M. Riddle. Got an award for special services to the school 50 years ago."
"How on earth do you know that?" said Harry in amazement.
"Because Filch made me polish his shield about 50 times in detention," said Ron resentfully. "That was the one I burped slugs all over. If you'd wiped slime off a name for an hour, you'd remember it too."
Harry peeled the wet pages apart. They were completely blank. There wasn't the faintest trace of writing on any of them, not even Auntie Mabel's birthday or dentist, 3:30.
"He never wrote in it," said Harry, disappointed.